Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Soon after the COVID-19 virus began snaking its way across the country last year, the race was on to develop a safe and effective vaccine that would protect the public from illness and death. Even before the coronavirus vaccines were granted emergency use authorization and were distributed to the public, false information and conspiracy theories began to swirl. That meant that finding the truth about vaccine safety and efficacy can seem elusive at times, even now, after the Food and Drug Administration granted full authorization to Pfizer. With so many stories circulating on social media and so much conflicting information, it can be difficult to separate fact from fiction when it comes to safety, as well as the legal implications surrounding the vaccine. Many people wonder if they're doing the right thing when choosing whether or not to vaccinate, while others are asking questions about whether employers, schools, and healthcare providers can legally require them to do so. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seewert. Today, we welcome two experts to discuss the latest research and findings on the coronavirus vaccine from both a health and legal standpoint. Our first guest is Dr. Jonathan Tempte. He's the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Tempte, welcome back to Route 51.
Well, thank you so much, Shireen. It is a pleasure to join you this morning.
Later in the program, we'll hear from Edward Falone. He is Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University Law School in Milwaukee. He'll take a look at the legal arguments surrounding the vaccine. Listeners with questions for our guests can join the conversation now by calling us at 800-780-9742. You can also email us at route51@wpr.org. Dr. Tempte, how do scientists determine vaccine efficacy? And what do we know about the efficacy of the COVID vaccines now?
Great question to start things out with. First and foremost, when a new vaccine is coming along, it is the duty of the manufacturer to provide data on how well that vaccine works. And these are generally set up as clinical trials, which in the trade we call randomized clinical trials, where we recruit a number of individuals and they get randomly assigned to receiving either the vaccine or a placebo. And I have to mention too that before we even get to this point, these vaccines are studied in smaller groups of individuals to look for side effects, to look for appropriate immune responses, and so on. So there's a phase one and phase two, but the phase three trials is where we really learn about that effectiveness. And so we randomize this group of patients or volunteers, we provide them with vaccine or placebo, and then we see what happens in the following weeks and months. As it turns out, with the coronavirus vaccines for COVID-19, these trials were incredibly large. The one, for example, for Pfizer vaccine utilized about 40,000 individuals, which is far larger than most of our trials for vaccines ever are. And that's really important to understand because the larger the trial, the more people who are receiving that vaccine, so roughly 20,000, the better precision we have at identifying adverse events and so on. As it turns out, with initially the Pfizer and then the Moderna and then the Johnson & Johnson, what we saw is very quickly the people who were getting vaccine were doing so much better than the people who were not getting the vaccine. And as it turns out, we had answers in terms of that efficacy by early December of 2020. And at that point in time, the estimates were about 91 to 95% effective in preventing vaccine. That means basically that if you're vaccinated, you have 10 or 20 times less likelihood of coming down with coronavirus or SARS-CoV-2 than you would if you received the placebo. But these trials went along very, very quickly because if you remember, the time that the trials were being done was during this enormous surge that we had in October, November, and December last year.
And we are seeing another surge, the Delta variant, responsible for the bulk of new infections in Wisconsin right now. Is the Delta variant more contagious And are the vaccines preventing infections from the Delta variant?
Yes and yes. So the Delta variant is far more transmissible than the original virus variant that we saw coming around. And if we think back to May of 2021, Wisconsin, the United States, and actually the world was dominated by this UK variant, the B117, or what we now call the Alpha variant. And it's just amazing that across the United States in middle of May, 77% of cases were Delta, were the Alpha variant. And then all of a sudden, the Delta variant, which originated, we think, in India, just took over. And so today, across the United States, we're about 96 to 98% Delta. It just swept in and took over. And what we see is viruses that have a greater ability to transmit tend to displace the previous viruses. And sure enough, we're seeing Delta taking over virtually everywhere. By our estimates, the original virus, we think probably on average would infect 2.5 people for every new case. So if I came down with coronavirus, on average, I would spread it to 2.5 more people. With the Alpha variant, that number was more like 4. And now with Delta, that number, if I'm exposed to people who are unvaccinated or not immune for other reasons, that number is more like 6 or 7 or 8. So it's that much more transmissible. And the really important thing for everybody to understand is that the more transmissible a virus is, the greater the population has to be that receives the vaccine to reach this thing called herd immunity. Right now, with a Delta variant, to achieve herd immunity, we have to be up somewhere between 85 and 90% immune or vaccinated to prevent this from continuing to spread. So that's really, in a nutshell, why that transmissibility is so very, very important and why it's so very important for everybody who has not been vaccinated to get vaccinated.
So if I've gotten the vaccine, can I safely stop wearing my mask and taking precautions? There's a lot of confusion about this.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer, unfortunately, is no, particularly when you're in crowded indoor situations. And let me explain why. Right now, we have had the Pfizer vaccine since December, Moderna since February, or January, and Johnson & Johnson since March. But those of us who received the Pfizer vaccine in December and January are getting out quite a ways on that, and we're starting to see waning of protection. And in addition, we think the Delta variant might be able to escape a little of that protection from the vaccine. So the latest study I've looked at is one from the CDC, just published about 2 to 3 days ago, looking at healthcare workers who were immunized back in the early phases of vaccines. And what they're finding is in the pre-Delta variant period, the protection was about 91% in terms of that vaccine effectiveness. And in the post-Delta period, that's dropped down to about 66%. And that type of number is really consistent with data we're seeing in the state of Wisconsin. So for Wisconsin as a whole, if I'm vaccinated, I have about a third of the risk of COVID-19 as I do if I'm not vaccinated. If I'm vaccinated, the good news is I'm more protected for hospitalization and I'm really well protected against death. And so let me take it back a little bit now, that one of the things that will happen with Delta is people can be vaccinated, can be exposed, and can become infected but not know it, what we call asymptomatic. And the problem there is we still might be able to spread this virus even though we're vaccinated and even though we feel just fine. And so at this point in time, when everything is surging and really increasing across the country, and in particular in Wisconsin, I think it's really important for each of us to have that personal responsibility to protect those around us.
I'd like to talk about some of the risks of the vaccine. This comes up in conversation frequently when I talk with people who are hesitant to be vaccinated. They are concerned about some specific things. One is blood clots. Blood clots, we know, also one of the biggest risks the virus itself presents. Some people have voiced concern that the vaccine could damage organs or cause blood clots. What do we know about that?
Well, this is really one of the most important concepts that we tend to refer to SARS-CoV-2, the causative agent of COVID-19, as a respiratory virus. And let me be clear, it really spreads by a respiratory route, so into your nose, into your mouth, and so on. But it really is a virus that targets your blood vessels. And as compared to influenza, which only targets your upper respiratory system, this virus targets virtually everything in your body. And it is a terrible virus. I would much rather come down with influenza than COVID-19. But that being said, we do know that being infected with COVID-19 results in clotting problems in your system. And we now have some evidence that even the long-term COVID or the long haulers syndrome is caused by micro blood clots all over the body, including the brain. Now let's transition over to the vaccines. There were reports of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine being related to blood clots. And in fact, in the safety assessments done by colleagues across the country in academic centers and CDC, it really does appear that there is a causation of the vaccine for blood clots, but it's at a very, very, very low rate. And in fact, the rate of blood clot with infection and significant blood clots is higher than the rate of blood clot after receiving the vaccine. And so I think at the end of the day that this is a vaccine that has now been provided in the United States to 364 million doses has been out there. That's an incredible number in a short period of time. Typical influenza year, we might get 130 million doses out. So think about almost three times the amount of vaccine going out. And it has been phenomenally safe. We do have reports. And the thing to keep in mind that CDC and others are constantly monitoring for these safety signals. So we do have safety signals, but I can reassure people that the safety things that we're seeing are incredibly, incredibly rare. The rates are incredibly low.
There is also concern about potential effects on fertility. Is there a risk there?
We see absolutely no risks. And let me go back when I was first talking about efficacy and talking about the early phase trials. We have a long experience with these types of vaccines in other models. So initially in animal models, showing absolutely no effect on the fertility, on ovaries, on testes, and so on, just no effect there. There is some concern I've seen in the literature about the possibility that COVID-19 infection can affect sperm levels. This is pretty controversial right now, so I think the jury's still out on that. But we do know that people who are pregnant have a high risk of COVID-19 outcomes that are tragic and severe. And so groups like the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, CDC, and others are all really promoting and recommending vaccination for any woman who's pregnant or in early or planning to become pregnant.
You're listening to Dr. Jonathan Tempte. He is our guest today on Route 51 as we separate fact from fiction on the safety and effectiveness of the coronavirus vaccine. Later in the program, we'll be speaking with Associate Professor Ed Filone from Marquette University about the legal arguments surrounding the vaccine, including the legality of mandates. Your questions and comments are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also email us at route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Dr. Jonathan Tempte, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, is our first guest today to discuss the latest research and findings on COVID and the coronavirus vaccines now being distributed. Later in the program, we'll hear from Associate Professor Ed Filone from Marquette University for a look at the legal issues and challenges that have emerged during the vaccine rollout. We'd like to hear your questions too. Email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. One of the most common arguments I hear from people who are hesitant to be vaccinated is that researchers rushed the development of this vaccine, so its effectiveness and safety may not be trusted at the same level as other vaccines. What is your response to that, Dr. Tempte?
Well, first and foremost, like so many other technologies that we've experienced over the last 20 years, the rate of development has just moved along very, very rapidly. And once we start getting into more of the molecular biology, the doors open very quickly to more rapid vaccine evaluation and development and approval. But for this particular vaccine, one of the features that really allowed the very, very rapid acceptance through emergency use authorization was the fact they were doing clinical trials during a period of time where there was this overwhelming surge of cases. And this really sped up the process. Let me go back a little bit. Many of your listeners might be familiar with the high-dose influenza vaccine. And the clinical trial for the high-dose influenza vaccine took almost 3 years to complete. And the reason why is that the very first year, there was a very low influenza year, and they just didn't accumulate sufficient cases. And so you have to wait until the next year to come along, accumulate some more. And as it turns out, the differential between the placebo or the group receiving high-dose versus regular dose, the differential wasn't that huge. And so the time to accumulate enough of a difference between the control group and the vaccine group was long. As it turns out, the more effective a vaccine is, the quicker you get to that endpoint. And so the testament to this vaccine was actually the rapidity at which you achieved the milepost that you were looking for. As it turns out, the safety assessment was about as we normally see, with a caveat that there were many, many, many more people in the clinical trials that really allow us. Now, as many of your listeners are also aware, the FDA had the full approval called the licensure of the Pfizer vaccine last week. And on Monday, the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices will be meeting to review all that information. This is an independent body of experts, and they will render their opinion as to whether or not we should move forward with a full recommendation for this vaccine. Now, I can't tell you which way they're going to go, but I've had the privilege of sitting on the CDC work group on this vaccine, and I've seen the information pertaining to the full licensure. And all I can say is this looks like an incredibly good and safe vaccine, and there are no surprises out there. And this is what the same information the FDA used to provide that full approval. And I think people can be very assured that no corners were cut, and this vaccine has been now in operation for, you know, almost 9 months in the United States. And we have seen not only incredible benefits, but very, very few downsides to the vaccine.
We've been hearing a lot of information about who should and should not get the vaccine. Are there risks for someone who is immunocompromised, say someone with RA or lupus or someone undergoing chemotherapy for cancer treatment? What do we know?
Well, we know that anybody who has one of these conditions, which we lump together in this huge category called immunocompromised conditions, are actually at higher risk for the bad outcomes of COVID-19. the hospitalization, the ICU visit, intubation, and potentially death. And so that's number one. Number two, we do know that vaccines are beneficial for these individuals, but they're not as beneficial as they are for people without these conditions. The reason being is whenever the immune system is compromised, we respond less well to things like vaccines. And so with that in mind, the FDA approved vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, so Moderna and Pfizer, for an augmentation dose. We don't call this a booster, but an augmentation dose for those people who are immunocompromised, who've already been fully vaccinated. So they're now getting a third dose of this vaccine. And we do know that for those individuals, we boost their antibody level and we increase their immunity against this virus. So right now the discussion shouldn't be, should I get the vaccine or not, but when can I get all three doses in for protection? And we have seen that so far, this has been a very, very safe approach. The other thing I'll just mention very quickly is at any one time out there, somewhere around 3% of the people we run into on the street, in clinics, grocery store, and whatever, are immunocompromised. So this is a common condition. Think about one out of every 30 to 35 people you meet have one of these conditions. And they're at high risk for COVID-19. So the more we can get these people protected, the better.
How long after being vaccinated should somebody get that extra dose?
Well, I think the current recommendation from CDC is at least 28 days. So, our two main vaccines used in the United States are Pfizer and Moderna. And these are both two-dose vaccines for the primary immunization series. And one is 28 days apart, one is 21 days apart. But the current recommendation is at least 28 days after that last dose. And, you know, if you got these way back in January, it's fine right now. There isn't any maximal period of time that you won't get a benefit.
How about people who have had COVID? How long do those COVID antibodies remain in the body after infection? I know some people say that they're not getting the vaccine because they've had COVID and they believe that they are now protected.
Well, let's say they are probably partially protected. And we really don't know how long these antibodies will persist. I have to kind of remind everybody, we have no previous knowledge of this particular virus beyond 18 months now. And so the earliest people infected are now only about 18 months out. And we're seeing some persistence, but we also see that people who are vaccinated compared to those who are unvaccinated, but previously infected, the vaccinated people have about a 50% reduction in likelihood of being infected. So those individuals who were previously infected can still get infected, and the vaccine will provide benefit to them like everybody else.
We have a caller, Gary from Stevens Point, has a question for our guest. Thanks for calling, Gary.
Hi, a couple of questions. I had a debate with a friend earlier this week. She insisted that there's no indicator for COVID or no indicator. I just looked at her with wide-eyed and I thought, I don't even know what that means. And my next question is, she presented to me, the CDC is not counting deaths caused by the vaccination, which I'm sure is a difficult thing to do, even under normal circumstances. That's it. That's my two
Thanks,
points
Gary.
I'd like to make. Thank you.
Yeah, very good. So the first question in terms of indicators for COVID, we have very, very precise tests. And the best are the reverse transcription polymerase chain reaction, or commonly referred to as PCR tests. And these are really the gold standard for detection of virus. They can detect low levels of virus, and there's not problems with cross-reactivity and so on. So number one, there are good indicators for COVID. And as of as of today, across Wisconsin, we have had, you know, somewhere around 650,000 laboratory confirmed cases. So that's better than one out of every 10 of us. Number two, there's a common myth that the CDC isn't counting deaths due to vaccine. And I can assure you that having a system that picks up on very, very low level things, such as the blood clots, we've heard of the inflammation or myocarditis of the heart, and so on. The safety system is fine-tuned to virtually anything out there of concern. So people can report deaths into something called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. This is run by CDC and the FDA. And I just caution people that you can find reports of deaths in there. What needs to be done at that point is to determine whether or not there was any causation or if these are coincidental. Keep in mind that a number of people who were vaccinated early were in long-term care facilities, and people who were in the last months of life to begin with. And what we're finding when we look in terms of other systems where we can look at people who are vaccinated versus not vaccinated and ask the question, well, what's the likelihood of death occurring in the next 42 days? I can assure you that is much, much higher in the group that is not vaccinated than the group that is vaccinated. So we have a lot of different angles to answer that question, but to say that this is not being looked at or attended to is patently false.
Let's talk about alternative therapies. We've heard a lot about this too. Alternative therapies to treat COVID, the one that people are talking about right now is ivermectin. It is being referred to in media sources as a horse dewormer, though of course it's used in humans as well. Is this potentially an effective treatment?
Well, and I'm going to add in, it's also used in kittens. We've recently fostered four kittens and familiar with the medication. So I can confess we have some in the cupboard. And I can also say that there was just a health alert that came out from the state of Wisconsin cautioning people against ivermectin because there have now been serious adverse responses to people overdosing on ivermectin. This became very, very popular, especially in the alternative media, but there is insufficient evidence for safety or efficacy for COVID-19. So I caution people from going out to the farm supply stores and picking this up and taking it. What you can buy over the counter is not approved for human consumption. And we don't have any good evidence or any good information on appropriate dosage, length of dosage, and again, really no information on any true benefit.
When do you expect young children will be eligible for the vaccine? And I also want to mention that the FDA's full authorization of the Pfizer vaccine means that pediatricians could, if they chose to, vaccinate kids younger than 11. Do you think that'll happen?
Yes. So the second part first, that with any fully licensed product in the United States, physicians have the ability to prescribe outside of the indication with a caveat, they're taking a risk for doing so. But moving on to the pediatric, the trials are being done. And unfortunately for those children from age 6 months up through age 12, or age 11, for which there isn't any vaccine right now. We're not expecting anything to be approved through the emergency use authorization until probably after Thanksgiving. It could be December, it could be January, which really brings in, you know, the importance of the next few weeks when we bring children back into the classroom in the midst of this big surge of a highly, highly contagious variant of COVID. And we just have to be very, very careful at this point in time. Unfortunately, across the country, we're seeing increasing rates of hospitalizations of children. In my county, in Dane County, the greatest growth right now in new cases are children under the age of 15. And so we just have to be very, very cautious. So I think in the news break, I heard that Kenosha has just instituted a mask mandate for the schools. And we see this across the state. I'm somebody who's spent the last 8-9 years studying transmission in school situations. And respiratory viruses are really, really easily spread from child to child. So we just have to be very, very careful as we go into the next few months.
Some scientists and health experts are now saying that herd immunity is perhaps no longer achievable, and that maybe it wasn't all along. Have we reached the point of no return where the virus is never going to go away completely?
Well, you know, I'm biased on this one because the very first training and exposure that I had to vaccine science was dealing with measles. And measles is a terrible virus. We tend to think of it as a benign childhood, but it's a horrendous. And back in the year 2000, about 1 million children were dying each year from measles. Measles has been eliminated from the entire Western Hemisphere, with the exception of Venezuela, where it was eliminated and came back. But this was done by a cheap and safe vaccine. And the reason I mentioned measles is it is far, far more contagious than even the Delta variant. And to bring this under control through vaccine is possible, even though the herd immunity threshold for this particular virus is more in the range of 93 to 95%. I think we can do this, but we can't do it without having a large proportion of our population fully immunized. And by a large proportion, when we look at Wisconsin at a little over 50%, we need to push this up more like 85, 90%. And we can only do that by reaching out to everybody who hasn't yet been vaccinated.
We've got about 30 seconds left or so. I'd like to ask you, what are some legitimate medical exemptions for vaccine mandates?
Well, the best legitimate is somebody who has had a severe allergic response to the first dose. Beyond that, there are very, very few and really fit into the category of having severe allergic responses to any of the ingredients of a vaccine. And this is something that if you have that, please have a discussion with your physician assistant, your nurse practitioner, and they can help review your medical history and see if whether or not this would apply.
Thank you so much, Dr. Jonathan Tempte, for appearing today on Route 51. We certainly appreciate your input. When we return, we'll hear from Edward Ballone, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette, for a look at the legal arguments surrounding the vaccine as more employers and schools and healthcare organizations are implementing mandates, many of which came down almost immediately after the FDA granted full authorization to Pfizer for its vaccine. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Back on Route 51, I'm Shereen Seward. Today, we're discussing the COVID vaccine from both a health and legal perspective. Earlier in the program, we spoke with Dr. Jonathan Tempte about the latest research on the vaccine while addressing questions about its effectiveness and safety. Now, we welcome Edward Ballone, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University in Milwaukee, for a discussion on the legal aspects of this issue. Professor Ballone, welcome to Route 51.
Hello, Shereen. I'm happy to be here.
One big question: are there legal grounds to oppose vaccine mandates in general?
Well, the legal landscape for vaccine mandates is fairly settled. Under a longstanding United States Supreme Court precedent, a case called Jacobson versus Massachusetts in 1905, we have a clear holding of the U.S. Supreme Court that vaccine mandates instituted by state government are constitutional. There are still going to be challenges. This is an old case, 1905. Constitutional law has evolved a bit. And I think in particular, you will see challenges based on people's religious beliefs. But I think if the bottom line is if a vaccine mandate by an employer or a government is drafted appropriately with exceptions, so it doesn't apply to persons who have an underlying medical condition that would be impacted by the vaccine, and exceptions so that it doesn't apply to persons with sincerely held religious objections to vaccines, all vaccines. If they're drafted in that context, they are lawful, they are constitutional, and they should survive any legal attack.
There are a lot of social media posts that are offering advice to people who refuse to take a COVID-19 shot and then lose their jobs as a result. The advice that's circulating basically is don't quit, let your employer fire you so you can get unemployment benefits and have a better standing to sue, perhaps. What are your thoughts on that advice that's been circulating?
I don't know that I have a legal response. I mean, certainly you see a lot of posts on social media that are disruptive. They're designed to make it harder for government to get voluntary compliance with public health measures or make it harder for private employers to get voluntary compliance. They're disruptive. I'm not sure what the purpose is other than to try and get in the way of community action on a broader basis. If individuals want to look at their employment as a vehicle for disrupting their employer's business and perhaps disrupting the public health, there's certainly nothing I or anyone else can do about that.
Few companies outside the healthcare industry require their staff to be vaccinated against the flu or any other communicable disease as a condition of employment. But hospital systems in several states have mandated vaccines for employees and new hires. There have been federal lawsuits that have followed. What are judges saying about this issue so far? Can a healthcare organization mandate that their employees must be vaccinated?
Yes, generally speaking, these vaccination requirements at hospitals and healthcare providers are being upheld from legal challenge. You know, you do not have a constitutional right to a job. So especially for a private employer, they can place conditions on your employment. And those conditions can include not exposing other workers to health risks. If it's a government employer, a state healthcare system or state hospital or county hospital, then you have state action when they impose those mandates, meaning that it's an official government policy. Then you might have some constitutional issues. You cannot have government violating your constitutional rights. But again, under longstanding Supreme Court precedent, a vaccine mandate, a requirement to be vaccinated, has not been held to implicate individual rights under the Constitution, and so it would be permitted even by government employers.
What about universities? More than 700 private and public colleges and universities, including Marquette in Wisconsin, have adopted vaccine policies that require vaccines. Do you think that these policies are going to hold up in court if they're challenged?
Well, I think they will, and we actually have a very recent example out of the Seventh Circuit, which is the federal appellate circuit, which Wisconsin is part of, a case called Claussen that just came out very recently. The Seventh Circuit upheld a vaccination requirement at Indiana University that applied to students, faculty, and staff. It did have an exemption for religious opposition and also for people who had medical conditions that would be impacted by the vaccine. But the Seventh Circuit upheld it, said it Jacobson was binding precedent, and that really, you know, individuals who go to college, it's a voluntary decision. You don't have to go to a university that has a vaccine mandate. You're free to find other places to get an education. And the vaccine mandate was upheld, and there was an appeal filed with the U.S. Supreme Court, which was denied, which would seem to indicate that there's not four justices on the U.S. Supreme Court who disagree with that Seventh Circuit opinion. So I think that Claussen case, it was very well stated, even though quite short, decided by Judge Easterbrook, who's a well-regarded judge on the Seventh Circuit. I think that that will be the leading case on the issue of university mandates.
If judges are upholding these mandates for schools, for companies, for healthcare companies, why do you think more employers aren't requiring them at this point?
Well, employers have other objectives they have to be concerned about. First of all, we're in a very tight labor market. Employers are having a hard time finding workers, period. And so they certainly don't want to have any job conditions that might scare off workers. Employers also are very risk averse when it comes to being sued. It's not to say that employees would have a legal basis to sue, but of course, even a frivolous lawsuit imposes costs on the employer to hire lawyers to defend themselves in court, and perhaps to pay out a nuisance settlement. And so I think employers are moving cautiously, except in those industries which really are impacted. So, for example, the cruise line, Norwegian Cruise Lines, which sued the state of Florida because it was prohibited by Florida law in asking customers whether they had been vaccinated under that Florida state law. And the Norwegian Cruise Line said, look, we'll be out of business if people don't think we're safe, and we need to take steps to have a safe product, a safe experience. So I think employers are unfortunately on the front line, unless and until we have more uniformity in government, state, and federal mandates and public health measures. Until we have that uniformity at the federal and state level, employers are sort of left to figure it out on their own.
You know, that brings up a really good point. Something I see a lot of discussion on is about privacy. And a lot of businesses are asking customers to wear masks if they're not vaccinated. And there's a question, like, is a business asking a customer about their vaccination status a violation of HIPAA? That's what people who are opposed to this say, that that's a HIPAA violation. Is that true?
No, that's not correct. You know, the internet is a wonderful resource to try and cherry pick information that you use to try and prove your predetermined point. And this is a good example of that. HIPAA is a law that protects your medical information from being disclosed by your health insurer or healthcare providers who have that information. It doesn't apply to employers in general. It doesn't apply outside of that context of healthcare providers and health insurers. So, and, you know, except in perhaps some very extreme, unusual situations, HIPAA, it would be irrelevant to an employer asking customers or their own employees whether they've been vaccinated.
There are a handful of cases that are cropping up where families are filing lawsuits after losing a loved one to COVID. There's a case in Florida, for example, that claims that a grocery store at the start of the pandemic prohibited employees from wearing face masks and gloves, despite CDC advice urging people to do so. So a deli worker at the store contracted COVID and died. The family's attorney in the lawsuit is calling the death completely preventable. That, I guess, brings up the question, do you think businesses could be held legally liable for COVID-related deaths if they don't follow public health guidelines?
It certainly is possible. It is important to emphasize the business is not responsible for the dangerous condition. So we're not talking about a parallel to a company that produces toxic chemicals, for example, and might have a very high standard of care in protecting its workers from that toxic chemical. We're talking about a threat that comes from outside the business. So really, the relevant law would be the law of negligence. And here the key issues would be, did the business depart? Did it have an extreme departure from a reasonable standard of care? So did they take any reasonable steps to protect their employees in the face of the known risk? And also a question of causation would be very important under the law of negligence. And that's, you know, can you prove that the person who contracted COVID and died, can you prove they contracted it at work? And that would be an obstacle for people suing. So if a company takes some reasonable precautions, masking, social distancing, whether or not they go that additional step to require vaccination, that may not be an extreme departure from a reasonable standard of care if they've taken other steps. But a company that doesn't make any attempt to protect its workers, it would be under some risk of a lawsuit should one of those workers get ill and should the family be able to demonstrate that it was contracted at the work environment.
What about when it comes to individuals? There's another case in which a family is blaming a loved one's death on a coworker's refusal to wear a mask. They're suing that coworker. How hard would it be to prove that the maskless coworker is to blame? And what do you think the outcome might be in that type of situation?
I think the same principles of negligence apply. I mean, certainly if there were evidence of intent, and you see this, one parallel might be cases that arise where individuals have been exposed to a sexually transmitted disease, for example, like herpes, or sometimes cases that arose based out of the transmission of AIDS. If there's evidence that the individual intentionally attempted to infect people or was completely aware of the risk of infecting others and didn't care, that would be one thing. But lacking that evidence, then you go back to general negligence. Were they behaving irresponsibly? And can you prove causation? Can you prove that the transmission was from that individual who was behaving in a negligent fashion? So those cases, if you don't have evidence of an intent to transmit the disease, those cases can be challenging, but they can be successfully litigated.
What about the idea of vaccine passports? What's the legal argument there?
Well, a vaccine passport is really, you're just talking about ways to demonstrate that you've been vaccinated. You know, it really doesn't have anything to do with the legality of requiring vaccination. It's just the question of how do you demonstrate compliance with it. As long as the means chosen, whether it's an app on the phone or some sort of documentation that you receive, as long as the means chosen to demonstrate that, yes, you meet the requirement are reasonable, they satisfactorily accomplish the goal, you don't have a lot of false results, it's relatively dependable, reliable, it shouldn't raise any legal issues.
One final question for you. One of the most heated discussions surrounding public health requirements is the balance between individual rights and public safety. Simply put, from a legal standpoint, do individual rights trump public health requirements?
No. From a legal standpoint, individual rights do not trump the good of the many or the good of the public. Certainly, as I've explained, under Supreme Court precedent and countless cases in the last 150 years, the good of the many trumps individual rights in a whole variety of contexts. Certainly, you can't yell fire in a crowded movie theater and cause a stampede and defend yourself by saying you have a free speech right. And there's just countless examples, and public health is one. It certainly doesn't, individual rights don't trump the public good as a matter of history or tradition in our country. What we do see now is there are certain groups who are bringing legal cases trying to establish a more libertarian view of the Constitution. They're trying to change this legal landscape. And there's nothing unusual about that. You know, groups have made concerted efforts to make our Constitution more equality-based or more gender-sensitive. This is something that is part and parcel of our legal history. But we should be very conscious of what's going on. These groups want to create a body of new laws, new precedent, that take a more libertarian view and that tie the hand of government and restrict government's ability to act for the common good. I don't think it will succeed. I certainly hope it doesn't succeed. They have every right to try, but I predict they will fail.
Thank you so much for your thoughts on these issues. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward. I'd like to thank our guests, Dr. Jonathan Tempte and Professor Edward Filone. Our producer is Joy Ratch-Kramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, Wisconsin Public Radio Communities reporter Rob Menser joins us for a look at what's happening